are listening to Truth to You Radio with Jono on truthtoyou.org. That's truth2u.org. Also available on iTunes. G'day to Eddie in South Carolina, Madeline and Adrian in Pennsylvania, and some comments. It is time for Light of the Prophets with Yoel Ben Shlomo. Yoel, we have some comments. I'm going to read some of those out. How are you, my friend?
I'm doing okay. You just have to lay off certain things, I think, sometimes before we talk.
We've just been talking for 40 minutes already, arguing about points in scripture until
and I'm going like, Jono, I have things to do today. I actually have
can
to...
Can we start the program?
My family and I have to move, and I have to go look at a house, so let's get on with it.
Let's whip through it. Okay, this is from Rick. Rick, g'day, Rick. Rick said, Jono, always...
First of all, Rick is I see comments by Rick all the time. We actually gave him a shout out a couple weeks ago.
We did.
So, Rick, how are you, my friend?
G'day, Rick. And he says, Jono, you always end your broadcast with be blessed, be set apart by the truth of our Father's word. My only response is, okay, you're on. Excellent. I hope you are so blessed, Rick. And he goes on to say, Yoel, once again, thank you for teaching us. May the Eternal One, blessed be He, bless you doubly for you, for each of us here that you bless. Wow, it's almost like a tongue twister.
You're welcome. You're very, very welcome.
Thank you, Rick.
And I actually want to say hello to Derek. Yes, Derek, who I actually know.
Hey, there we go. Derek says, keep them coming.
Yeah, we will do. We'll do.
We will do. Darren says, thanks again, Yoel and Jono. He says, so now remember you and I spoke about the glue, being glued to God. He said, so with the Torah and how we apply it, be the glue used to bind us to the God of Israel with his people, because most of my life I think I've been using the wrong glue, says Darren.
Well, there's actually crazy glue. So there's a brand called Torah. That's the crazy glue you want to use.
That's the glue that you want. Amen.
Yes. The thing. Okay. So there's actually a concept that we can't really approach God, because it says Esho Chelahu is a consuming fire. Mm-hmm. So the way for us to approach God is basically through the Torah.
Amen.
So I would say that is the glue.
It's never a good idea to approach a fire with glue. Jono said, I really enjoyed this episode. Thank you, Yoel and Jono, for all the work you do to bring us this wonderful information. And Catherine had a question. What's the question?
Okay, yes. Catherine's question. Oh, you're going to read it? I'm not wearing my glasses. You read it.
Okay. Catherine said, thank you, Yoel and Jono. Could you please help me to understand the process of 10 men required to speak out loud prayers? Is this daily and Sabbath prayers? And also, am I sinning against the Father by speaking daily prayers out loud, being a female? I download from Nehemiah's site daily and Sabbath prayers, and I have been speaking them out loud for over a year, and I actually love to read them out loud. It has also helped me to remember Scripture. I do value your wisdom, and I am young in my understanding. Please help. Blessings to both, and thank you so much for your teachings. So, remember we spoke about the 10 men, and what's your view on that?
What's my view on that? Well, so first of all, before we actually start the actual program, I want just to say something very, very quick.
Sure.
As I posted not long ago that a friend of mine died from a diabetes complication.
Mm.
The thing is that I actually... No, I knew him for a very, very short time. His name was Paul Gomez, and I actually met him through Rico Cortez. And I just want to dedicate this lesson to in his memory, and I also want to dedicate this lesson to his fiance, who unfortunately is actually kind of broken from this story, obviously.
Mm.
And I just want to pray for her that she'll find strength, and that Paul's children, because he was married before he met her, mm-hmm. also find strength. Paul was actually an atheist, and it's pretty amazing how the Almighty works. Paul was an atheist until he met his fiance, and she's the one who brought him into faith. And I just really want to dedicate this lesson to him, to his fiance Rachel, to his children. My guess is everyone really misses him, and I'm really, really shocked by it, because my father has diabetes as well, pretty serious diabetes. He had serious diabetes as well, and it killed him in the end. So I want to pray for healing for his family as well. Amen. And also basically, if you know someone who has diabetes and they're not doing anything to help themselves, I mean, Paul was doing something to help himself, but his situation was very, very advanced. My father's situation is very, very advanced. My father's also not that young anymore. Mm-hmm. So, my father's 62, so it's normal that the body starts weakening. Though 60 is not that old. But if you know someone who has diabetes and they're not taking care of themselves, it is really a life-saving deed to explain to them what they're doing to themselves and to help them, to encourage them to stop living the lifestyle they're living, because unless they have what's called juvenile diabetes, which hits children and teenagers, there's nothing you can do about it. Convince these people to change their lifestyle, change what they eat, and they can actually reduce the problems. And they always have to be very aware of what their body's doing.
Mm-hmm.
So after saying that, because I understand something, I actually cried when I heard this.
Mm.
It was very painful for me to hear that he died.
Yeah, it's terribly sad.
It's sad. And so, again, if you know someone who has diabetes and they're not taking care of themselves, just make sure they realize what's going on. Don't scare them, but make sure they realize what they're doing, because you're going to be saving them.
Amen.
And I think that's a righteous deed, at least in my mind. I think it's a righteous deed.
Amen.
So now that I've put that out of the way, because I was thinking before we did the show, I was thinking.
No. So for this show, in memory of Paul Gomez and in awareness of diabetes, and I'll mention that, we often actually do talk about diabetes and some of the things that you can do to move away from those repercussions of diabetes and heading down that path. We talk about that a lot on the Cultured Karaite with Deborah. Mm-hmm. And actually, you know what? We're going to be mentioning her a little later in this program of Light and the Prophets. But talk about that. We'll talk about that later. But Paul Gomez, Paul.
Yeah, and I'll tell you something. I was also very, very overweight, and my sugar levels started going up. And I'm only 30. Now everyone knows my age. And I just took myself in my own hands, and I'm working out now and watching what I'm eating. I mean, I was grossly overweight to a point where my blood pressure was extremely high. I started losing my vision. It was becoming difficult to find clothing, and now, thank God, after my very, very good friend Rico Cortez spoke with me about a certain type of workout that I can do without having to leave home, and I started researching the issue of dieting. I've been dieting based on a certain system for quite a while, and believe me, it helps you focus, it helps you work, it helps you really be a better person. And, when you sit down, for example, if we're going to do it Torah-related, when you sit down and you study Torah, you're a lot more focused.
Mm-hmm.
You pick things up a lot faster. You have the ability to study more. Even if you have, say, 10 minutes to study your day, you're working. And, when I was working in the food industry, really, 12 hours a day, I reach home, I'm completely exhausted. But that, when you have like that 10, 15 minutes just to sit down and read, you can read a lot in that 15 minutes if you're focused.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the benefits. Besides being big and strong and everything, besides all those things, being a true warrior of God, you can also use it on the mental aspect of it as well. So it's worthwhile being healthy. And we actually have a saying, "Nefesh bria beguf bari," a healthy soul and a healthy body. It's actually a concept which was said by Maimonides, who happened to be a doctor as well.
Mm-hmm.
So he wrote actually the medicinal writings. Which many of them are inaccurate as far as I know, but it's still the idea of being healthy to enable you to actually live longer and actually fulfill Torah for a longer time, being able to understand Torah better just by being a lot more focused.
Mm-hmm.
So going to Catherine's question. So first of all, the concept of having 10 men is actually something which is mostly practiced in rabbinical Judaism. I mean, we find this idea of a congregation being of 10 in the Bible, for example, the issue with the 10 spies, so they're called an Eidah, Ad Matay Le'Eidah Hara'azot, until when will this evil congregation continue? So we find that here and there. I mean, it's not something that's like, there's hints of it here and there. I mean, again, the Bible can't give us details of everything, but it gives us a general idea. But again, it's a rabbinical concept, and we don't find anywhere in the Bible that you have to have 10 men to do it. It's a rabbinical practice, and we usually say that prayers to be recited out loud, we have to have 10 adult free, because they also had slaves at the time, so 10 adult free men to conduct a full service. what is sometimes done, if there's no, you know, if there's no 10 men, at least, you know, there's certain sections that can still be recited out loud. It's really a limitation on what's called the Amidah, which, by the way, has nothing to do with what Catherine has downloaded from the Chemi's website. In the Karaite community, they don't actually require 10 men or 10 of anything. I mean, I remember I went to the Karaite synagogue in Jerusalem in the Old City, and I walked in, and the guy who used to run the place said, told me, can you join me? And I'm like, okay, listen, I know what the Siddur is like. It's this praise of God. It's not something that contradicts any of my beliefs. So I went down with him into the synagogue, and we read everything out loud. Okay, he had to explain to me certain things. You know, we do this, we do that. Basically, he said, follow my lead, because I don't really, you know, I usually go to a rabbinical synagogue, but I don't see anything wrong with the Karaite prayers. You know, it's just psalms and verses. There was no need for 10 adults. You know, there was no need for, by the way, when we say adult, we mean someone from 13 upwards, which is interesting. Okay. Why 13, but it's probably because that's an age where young men start looking like men instead of being children.
Sure.
Beards start sprouting and things like that. Now, regarding the issue of being a female, we don't find, at least from what I've noticed, we don't find in the Bible anywhere. I mean, when I say Bible, I mean the Tanakh. When I'm not referring to the New Testament, I don't really know much about the New Testament. As my friend Rico likes to call it, the first century writings. Mm-hmm. I don't see any problem with reading out loud, even if you're a woman. I mean, I remember when I first visited a Karaite synagogue, and I actually was with the chief so-called quote-unquote rabbi. Because he's not really a rabbi, he's a chacham. And I remember I was standing there in the synagogue, and I wasn't the only rabbinical Jew there. Was some man, I think I know exactly who he was, and he was in there as well, and was willing to he wanted to see what their prayers are like. And I was standing there, and I could hear women as well. Mm-hmm. They had like a women's balcony. And I remember I actually asked, why do women have a balcony? Why do they pray with us? And he said, I was answered, because we also have to bow down. And it's slightly immodest. So, for example, in the Karaite synagogue in Jerusalem, it's a very, very old synagogue, so they didn't really have the concept of a balcony. Mm-hmm. So what they have is the men in the front, the women are in the back. So sure. So when they bow down, men don't really, you know, they can't look back. There's no way of doing it. So I was standing there, and I could, you know, they were reciting, the man who conducts the prayer read out something, and then I could hear women answering in the back. So I don't think there's any problem with that. You know, besides the fact that I don't see in the verses, I also don't see, I also know of a practice that shows there's no problem with it. So, you know, when you have something written and the practice, it's always even better. Mm. By the way, I'll point out that the women were the one who started singing after the crossing of the Dead Sea. Sorry, the Red Sea.
Yes.
Not Dead
yes.
Sea, Red Sea. Mm. You know, so I don't really see any problem with this. It's kind of funny. I actually made a joke a couple of days ago. There's a big book fair, the Hebrew book fair here in Israel. It's like this is like my... you know, my extra celebration every year, because I've been going to this book fair, I don't know, for like 20 something years since I was a small child.
Yeah,
and it's all over the country, so no matter where you live, there's always a book fair somewhere nearby.
Mm-hmm.
So I actually probably have even books that I bought in the first book fair I went to. I think I still have some of the books from like 20 odd years ago. The first books I bought in the book fair.
You're gonna end up opening your own library one day, I think.
No, I've actually got rid of a lot of books. A lot of books. I've actually digitized a lot of my books and just sold them or whatever it is.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when I say digitized, I just bought a digitized version of it instead of having, you know, up to a million books in a library. I mean, I probably had over 1,000 books at one point, and I got rid of many of them. I think I'm down to like 300 or something like that. Regarding the issue of the prayer book itself, I mean, what you download is some kind of I think it's a variant. I'm not too sure. I've never really gone over, but I think it's a variant of a shortened version, or maybe it's a long version. I'm not too sure, of the Karaite prayer book, which is interesting. You know, it's actually, remember the first time I looked through it and I actually joined a prayer, I actually enjoyed it. It was a lot more enjoyable than for example the what we do in the rabbinical synagogues.
Mm-hmm.
So I sometimes have this yearning to find, you know, go to the old city and go into the synagogue there. And pray with whoever is there. But essentially, it's a bit of an issue, because if you know, the moment you kind of start getting slightly involved with Karaites, you know, rabbinical Jews have these camera radars under their heads. Like, what are you doing? I'll tell you a small story that happened years ago, and then we'll get into the actual verses themselves. I remember I was studying in the yeshiva in the old city many years ago. It was 12 or 13 years ago. And next to this yeshiva was the Karaite synagogue. So this yeshiva is called the Yeshivat HaKotel. And I remember I was interested in many things. You know, I was, and I remember this was one of my first serious encounters with Karaites. And it was a really, really nice, wonderful family living there, which I'm still in touch with one of their sons here and there when I actually get to meet him. And remember we had a discussion and someone saw me sitting there in the little museum they used to have. They actually moved the museum to a different side of the building. Someone walked by. So a couple of days later, someone approaches me and says, "We saw you were sitting with the carrots." And I'm like, "Yeah, why would that be a problem?" And my head's going, thought police. And they said to me, "You know, there was a guy who went to one of the yeshivot here in Jerusalem, and he spoke with them, and he became a Karaite. And he happens to be a friend of mine these days." We're not talking about Nehemiah, we're talking about someone else. Mm. And I remember it was like, and I'm going like, "Okay. And your point is?" but I basically they threatened to throw me out of the yeshiva if I don't comply to what they said. So you know what I did? I left.
Amen.
I left. Great. I went to a different yeshiva who actually encouraged as much knowledge as possible, so they had no issue with me talking with Karaites.
In a sense, it was like being blacklisted because you spoke to a communist or something like that, you know, back in the day.
I would say it's very similar. Yeah, see, there's thought police everywhere.
Yeah.
It's almost in any group that thinks they know what God wants. You know, as I think I pointed out this before. You know, if you've ever seen the movie Kingdom of Heaven. God wills it, you know. You're the spokesman of God now. Okay. Thumbs up. You walk away. But it's very, very, very common that people just make their own decision. This is why usually when a decision has to be made, the most seasoned and experienced people sit down to make that decision, not some individual decide something. Okay? Mm-hmm. So this is why it's when there's a trial, it's usually done by the elders at the gate with Levites and priests and people who know what they're doing. And if there's a dispute, we go to the highest authority. But here, people, it's humanity is humanity is humanity, and people suspect one another all the time because we have to learn how to become more humble. We have to learn how to be pious and humble. It says in Proverbs many times, before pride, there's piousness. You know, you have to learn to understand if someone's doing something, always think before you actually open up your mouth. Don't immediately go into an attack. Unfortunately, people do this all the time, and I get messages from people, and I'm all alone here, and people are attacking me and saying I'm now under the Torah and stuff like that. And I always tell them, listen, be encouraged. Maybe they'll learn something.
Yeah, and I've seen it happen, and it's an amazing thing, but it can happen. Exactly. Amen. Hey, listen, you mentioned the song of Moses, the song of Miriam. If we get a chance, we may even get to the song of Devorah, which is another example of what you were saying.
That's brilliant. Exactly. Thank you. I forgot about that. She sang a song.
She sang a song, which is full of praises to God, isn't it?
It's full. It's actually considered to be one of the complex chapters in the entire Bible. Mm. There's several things that are considered to be very, very complex. That's one of them. The other one is the book of Job. To a point where Nehemiah, I remember I was sitting with Nehemiah and I said something, you know, Book of Job is really, really strange. You know, this is one, and this is one of the first discussions I had with him. Oh, I can't remember exactly when. And he goes like, he says to me, we used to have a saying in the university, never bring an example from Book of Job. Really? Because it's just that when you look at the Hebrew there, it's like, what on earth are you talking about?
Sure.
I remember I sat for 3 months reading the Book of Job. And I sat for 3 months trying to read that book, and I only understand some like bits of it. It's really complex. So I actually remember it was one lesson I told a student. I said, you know, I can answer questions anywhere in the Bible except for the book of Job. And she looks at me, well, we're using the Skype, she looks at me and says, that's the point. I actually have a question in the book of Job. And I'm like, ah! So I say, you know what, let's try. She threw the question out there, and I'm like, okay, that's easy. That one's easy. You know, I was expecting like, you know... certain grammatical issues of why this word is used in this way, and it's just strange. The whole book is very, very strange in Hebrew.
Well, Speaking of, speaking of books that begin with J, but of course they begin with Yud, Joshua, Judges, Job, but Judges is where we are. And actually, I wanted to ask you about your name a little later on, because we talk about, well, I'll tell you what, we'll get there eventually, but...
What, Yoel and Yael?
Yeah!
not related at all.
At all?
Spelt differently, have different meanings completely, no relationship whatsoever.
Well, she turns out to be an absolute heroine. We're going to get there. Listen, just a reminder to everybody, it's the Light of the Prophets, and we're in the Book of Judges, and we're kicking off today.
But this is what sometimes happens, you know, yeah, if you're Jewish, you schmooze.
We've been schmoozing now for,
You won't be Jewish if you don't schmooze.
Okay, I want to remind all the listeners.
This is not schmoozing. No, answering.
You remember what Yoel said when we started, you know, come on, let's get on with it. I've got to go somewhere. And now we're schmoozing. And whose fault is it?
Okay, it's your fault.
So yeah, today we're kicking off in the Book of Judges from Judges chapter 3, right? Is this where we're up to?
Yes, we're in Judges chapter 3. I'm not too sure what we are. Okay, we're Judges 3, right.
Let's go for 3. And it starts like this. It says, now these are the nations which Jehovah left that he might test Israel by them. Boy, don't they. That is, all who had not known, any of the wars in Canaan. This was only so that the generations of the children of Israel might be taught to know war. Interesting. How about that? Explain that to me. Verse 2, this was only so the generations of the children of Israel might be taught to know war, at least those who had not formerly known it.
Yes. You know, there's an issue of if you want to have a kingdom and a strong one, you have to have soldiers. You know, you can't just say, oh, we're going to join up and sing Kumbaya or something. It doesn't work like that.
I find this fascinating. And I think we talked about this because it seems like, when I read that, it seemed to me like God expects us to know how to handle ourselves. And he leaves some of these people here kind of like training. Here's some training for you guys. You guys need to be trained in the art of war. You guys need to know how to look after yourselves. This seems like something he expects us to engage in.
I agree.
Interesting.
I agree. I think that this is something that also answers last week's question. Exactly. I mean, I can't expand this. I think you're right.
I just found that really interesting. And it goes on to say that, namely the five lords. I've got the five lords of the Philistines or the Canaanites, the Sidonians, the Hivites, who dwelt in Mount Lebanon from Mount Baal.
Lebanon.
From Mount Baal.
No, there's no dagesh in the bet.
Hermon? What?
It's Lebanon. Hebrew, we pronounce it Lebanon.
I've got the English in front of me. Stop making fun of me. So Mount
I'm making funny. I'm helping you. I'm correcting you. I'm Hermon's. Also your Hebrew teacher, as if I need to remind you as well.
HebrewInIsrael@gmail.com. At the entrance of Hamat. And these were left that he might, again, it says, these were left that he might test Israel by them to know whether they would obey the commandments of Jehovah, which he had commanded their fathers by the hand of Moses. So there's another reason. So he's left them there to test the Israelites. He's left them there as training so that they would know the skills of war, and he has left them there to see whether or not they would obey the commandments. Thus the children of Israel dwelt among the Canaanites, the Hittites, the Amorites, the Perizzites, the Hivites, and the Jebusites, and they took their daughters to be their wives and gave their daughters to their sons, and they served other gods.
Yeah, and the Torah actually warns that. It tells them, eradicate them so you will not take their daughters, and you won't give your daughters away, so they will not teach you the ways of their idols. And it actually happened. So,
and they did it. And there it is wrapped up in verse 6. So the children of Israel did evil in the sight of Jehovah. They forgot Jehovah their God, and they served the Baals, and I can never pronounce this, Asherahs.
Asherot.
Asherot.
Asherot, yeah.
That's the plural.
The Asherah was basically either a tree or a wooden pole.
Uh-huh.
And it basically represented the fertility goddess of Asherah.
Mm. And therefore, the anger of Jehovah was hot against Israel, and he sold them into the hand of Cushan Rishathaim. Is that correct?
Yeah, it's a Cushan Rishathaim. It's a strange name. He was actually the king of Aram, which was one of the first empires or miniature empires. Actually, what's very interesting, they found some kind of tablet that actually has what they think is a feminine equivalent of this name, which is Kasharashati. which they say might be an effeminate equivalent, but because there was a claim that this name was basically a game on, his name was Kushan, and Rishatayim, they saw is from the word Rasha, so they thought, well, maybe it's not a real name, and then they discovered, when they discovered Kasha Rashati, and they understood that maybe the original name was Kushan Rashati, and they added the Ayin there to make the root Rasha, which means evil. So they're basically talking about him being Kushan the evil one, or something to that extent. But again, it actually might be the actual name itself.
Okay. So I've actually got in my notes here of my study Bible, it says, and I don't know if this is right, but it says Kushan Rishataim, his name means Kushan of double wickedness. Is that possible?
Yeah, there's the Rishatayim. Is it what's called? It's a dual. It's called a dual.
Yeah. So therefore the double.
There's if you have a patach and then yud with a chirik and a final mem, that's a different pattern. If you have chirik yud and a mem, that's a plural. If you have a patach yud and chirik, basically the symbol is, I always, this is how I teach it, the difference, the way you identify the difference between a plural and a dual is the yud vocalized. Mm-hmm. Or when I teach, I try to find one thing for you to remember instead of remembering the whole pile of stuff. One thing to remember, which will be the key to it. So I always say, if you vocalize the yud, that's a sign of a dual. So a dual basically is something when we want to say two of something. So you can say double wickedness here. It's actually true. So when I said, you know, of great evil or something like that, you can put something as a dual to emphasize it. You know, if it was just Rishaim, Kushan Rishaim, then it sounds as if this is a group. So they decided to use Rishataim. In a specific way.
And so 8 years.
Because Rishatim has no meaning in Hebrew, by the way. So Rishatim is a formula that works. So we're trying to express like a lot of evil. This guy was really mean.
And they were under him for 8 years, this evil. And then the children of Israel cried out to Yehovah, and Yehovah raised up a deliverer for the children of Israel. What was his name?
Otniel ben Kenaz. We spoke about him last week as well, the little brother of Caleb.
Yeah. Yeah, because Caleb gave his daughter to be his wife, right? We talked about that.
Yeah. So he was not only his little brother, he was also now his in-law.
So
his nephews, Caleb's nephews, were also his grandchildren.
Yes. So now this guy is kind of like the first judge. This is the first one that we focus in on. And verse 10.
He's still living when Joshua, when he was around, when Joshua was alive, when Caleb was still around. So this is like, he's the first judge. So he's Joshua is dead, which means Caleb was probably very, very young when he received Achsa, the daughter of Caleb.
Mm-hmm.
And now he's a man, he's an adult, and he's become a judge. But again, we don't know how old he is here. But the one thing that's very clear is that this is already after Joshua died, and the elders that entered the land died as well.
It's one of these cases where it all happens. We don't get all the detail. It just all kind of happens in verse 10.
Yeah, well, basically, this is what happens. We have several stories that are short. They just mention the person who was the enslaver, or sometimes it doesn't even mention who was the enslaver. It just mentions it was a judge, and we have a few of these. And it elaborates on other stories. You know? And it's a good question why these stories were picked and these stories were not picked. And sometimes it can be because there was no story to really tell. It was just a war and that's it. And there wasn't anything unusual to be told.
Mm-hmm.
But again, why does someone decide to write something in a certain way is always a very, very good question. You know, when you, for example, take high criticism of the Bible, one of the problems with high criticism is that instead of trying to think, what did the writer think? They're trying to introduce what we're thinking into the text.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's and then they ask stupid questions and really, really stupid answers. no, really. I mean, I've been looking at high criticism lately for the past couple of weeks, and I've noticed that some of the questions they ask are sometimes extremely, really, really funny. Sometimes, you know, if you're a Hebrew reader, you will not ask this question because it's really simple. And I actually read through several books to look at certain possible answers to some of these questions, and it's interesting. You call yourself a scholar and you don't really know what you're talking about.
There's a lot of that going on, no doubt.
Happens, unfortunately it happens.
No doubt. The Spirit of Yehovah came upon him and he judged Israel. That's about it.
So it's interesting that he has to have the Spirit of God on him to do these actions. In other words, to be able to do something, not necessarily to do something, but if to enable us for one to stand fiercely against a massive enemy, there's divine intervention here. Natural, mm-hmm. but divine. So mm-hmm. It's very, very interesting, this thing. So, for example, when you take the Israeli wars, the 67 war, the 48, 53, the 67, 73, and also the 82, but really after 73 there wasn't any real wars. And as you know, 82 was a real war as well. And it's pretty amazing what was done. I mean, there's a chapter in Nehemiah's book that talks about the 73 war, which is the Yom Kippur war. And I just read that chapter and my mind was blown.
Oh, he tells it so well.
He tells it very, very well.
Shattering the Conspiracy of Silence. It'll be out very, very soon. And when it does come out, everybody has to rush out and buy it. My goodness, it is an awesome book. And in it, you're absolutely right. He talks about the Yom Kippur War, and it really is riveting.
Mm-hmm.
And it does. It shows it's an excellent example of how there is divine intervention that just can't be ignored, that God intervenes and these things happen.
Mm-hmm.
Mm. So anyway, he goes out to war, and God delivers this doubly evil guy into his hand, and that's it, really. And
that's basically it. Go to war, and that's it.
Then he dies. So the land had rest for 40 years, and then Othniel, the son of Kenaz, he died. So now here's a story. Here's one that they chose to go into some detail.
Now we're going to have a story with some details, exactly. So there's actually a series here. We're going to have the story here.
And this is a cool story.
I don't know. It's very, very short. And we have the story of Ehud here.
It's a little bit gory.
It's not that gory.
And the children of Israel did evil in the sight of Jehovah. So Jehovah strengthened Eglon, king of Moab, against Israel because they had done evil in the sight of Jehovah. Then he gathered to himself.
So by the way, his name is Eglon. So Eglon. The on ending is a whole discussion by itself. But the root of the word is Egil, which means an ox or a calf of sorts. Which might be a more of a nickname for him, because we'll see in a moment.
So let me say it again. Eglon, is that better?
Eglon.
Okay. Then he gathered to himself the people of Ammon and Amalek, and they defeated Israel and took possession of the city of Palms. The city of Palms?
Yeah, so the city of Palms is probably Jericho. Probably. Okay.
Oh, that's right. You did. You pointed that out last
time. We mentioned this last time, yes.
Indeed. So the children of Israel served Eglon, king of Moab, 18 years. 18. But when the children of Israel cried out to Jehovah, the Lord raised up a deliverer for them, Ehud, the son of, now how do we pronounce that? Gera. The Benjamite. Oh, Yoel. He's from he's a Benjamite, and he's left-handed. Now, you know what that reminds me of?
What does it remind you of?
I'm going to go a little bit further into the Book of Judges.
Oh, in the Book of Judges, a lot of the people from Benjamin were left-handed, apparently. They had some kind of a genetic
defect.
I don't know if you call it a defect, but at those times it was considered to be a defect. If you were not right-handed, you were not, you know, you were. It was considered to be a physical defect, which is kind of interesting. You know, why?
I don't know. But, hey, listen, let me ask you.
Right-handed people, it's easier for them, yeah.
Really?
Yeah, it's easy if you're right-handed. It's from what I've noticed, because my brother's left-handed.
Yeah.
And the struggle of having to have your hand cross to the other side and start writing is a bit difficult. Okay. If you're writing with your right hand, it's a bit easier. But again, if you're left-handed, you know, it doesn't get in the way, because if you're used to using right hand, your left hand, then it's the same thing. It's like the left hand, right hand is exactly the same. It's just functions of the brain. But what's very interesting is I remember I heard a story from this elderly man. He learned, you know, he was a child in somewhere in Europe. And he was Jewish, and Jews being, you know, knowing the Bible to a certain degree, always understood that being left-handed was some kind of a defect. So when he was a child, he started showing signs of writing with a left hand. So his parents used to force him to have his left hand down, and sometimes even, you know, tied down to the chair or something, violently tied down, but, you know, put something to keep the left hand down, so who always uses his right hand. And that's how he became right-handed.
And that's not unheard of. I remember my mother telling me stories like that about kids at school, and they don't do it anymore, obviously. But daughter is left-handed, yeah. Mm-hmm. But it's interesting, isn't it?
My brother's left-handed. I can see a certain level of struggle mean, when he writes in English, you know, it's easier for him because he's starting from the left.
Mm-hmm.
And when he wants to write from the right, I can see the slight struggle. But for example, when I write in English, you know, I write Hebrew and English, and I turn to the English, and I don't feel any difficulties. It's not as if, you know, unless you're used to writing from both ends, you might have, if you're left-handed, you might have a bit of a struggle writing from right to left.
Yeah.
You get used to it, and it goes away.
So in Judges chapter 20, verse 16, among all this people, and we're talking about Benjamin, 700, there were 700 select men who were left-handed. Everyone could sling a stone at a hair's breadth and not miss.
So you see, being left-handed is not a problem.
That's right. There it is. There's one for the left-handed people. So
left-handed people rule unless you're right-handed, and then you rule even more.
And so that's a key point though. This guy Ehud, he was a left-handed man.
It's important for the story.
He made himself a dagger. I've got it. Was double-edged and about a cubit in length. Now, cubit is, now correct me if I'm wrong. You tell us.
But it doesn't say ama. It says gomed. So that's a mistranslation. The gomed itself is a big discussion. What the gomed is. And one of the commentaries I've seen on the word gomed was it's from the word gamad, which means a midget or a dwarf. And it was a measurement which was the length of a cubit, because the cubit is basically how your arm or your hand, basically from the inner part of your, you know, the elbow, so the other side of it, whatever that's called.
So your forearm.
Basically your forearm all the way to the end of your longest finger. And that was how they measured things. That's how they measured things. And so they said, I saw a commentary that said that gomed actually was the size of what a dwarf or a midget would have. So it was a short dagger, less than a cubit.
Maybe less than a cubit. So maybe we're talking over a foot, but probably less than a foot and a half. Whatever it was...
So a cubit, there's also a big discussion how long a cubit is. Now, cubits from that time, again, were relatively short, but there were different types of cubits around the world.
Sure.
In the Second Temple period, for example, they had the Roman cubit, which was 44.4 centimeters long, which is about 18 inches, I think. I think you're right. We don't use inches here in Israel.
No, that'd be about
and then
right.
there was the Egyptian royal cubit, which was even longer. It was like 21 inches or something like that. And then there's very small cubits of 42 centimeters, which is about 17 inches. And there were different types of cubits. So from this time, the cubit was probably something relatively small. So it was probably more like the 18-inch, maybe even 16-inch cubit.
Sure. And it has to be so, really, because he's fastened it to his thigh, his right thigh. And I would imagine that it would have been on the inside of his right thigh. To conceal it properly,
not necessarily. I don't think, you know.
Have
you ever tried to strap something into your inner thigh?
No.
I mean, when I was in the army and we had to strap a knife to our thigh or something or a gun, we always put it on the outside. We don't put it in the inside.
Yeah, I know. But think about it. He's left-handed.
When you're trying to sneak something in, I'll tell you the problem. There's two layers of a problem here. If you put it inside your inner thigh. If you're a man, I don't know how much space you're actually going to have there to put it in.
It's pointing down. Believe me, it's pointing down.
No, I'm not talking about pointing down, but the problem is it disrupts your walk. Now, there's another thing that's going on here. First of all, in your inner thigh, you have a lot more space. There's a lot more space to put it in. But also it mentions something. It mentions here, v'yachgor ota tachat mitachat lemadav. Now, so it actually mentions here that he was wearing a thing called madav, which is basically the word madim, which is a uniform. Now, we find the word madim in another place where it talks about, in Exodus, where it talks about the clothing that the priests were wearing, and they were also called madim. It says midovad. It says midovad to his measurements. So it means he was wearing something which was probably, he was probably wearing something a bit more respectful because he's going to see the king. Now, this is a delegation. You don't show up in a delegation, wear a pair of jeans and a t-shirt.
Sure.
You know, usually when you go meet someone important, usually what do you wear a suit? Or at least wear something respectful.
Sure.
So he was wearing special clothing here. Now, one of the rules I always keep on telling people is, first of all, the sentence, no shirt, no shoes, no service. Mm-hmm. So in the ancient world, at least during the summer, men didn't wear shirts. All that men wore were skirts around their waist, which usually came down about to their knees.
Yes.
And if you're the more important you were in society, the longer your clothing were.
Mm-hmm.
So first of all, we learn something about Ehud here. First of all, he's probably He's not selected just being a Joe Schmo. He's probably important. He's well known. And this is why he can lead the delegation. Okay. And he's also probably wearing longer clothing, which means it'd be easier for him to conceal the weapons.
Fair enough.
Might be even wearing clothing in several layers.
I've always imagined him to reach down under his tunic or whatever it is that he has on, to reach down under on the inside of his right thigh, pull out this dagger, and then do what he does with it. But what you're suggesting now is that he's got more clothing on potentially. And it may be on his outer thigh. It may be on his outer thigh because he has more clothing to conceal it. And so how does he maneuver to get it? We don't really know, I suppose.
So again, he wasn't wearing something very, very long. So all he has to do is lift up his skirt, throw his skirt up, grab the dagger, and just charge.
Mm.
And what he does, he probably does a frontal. He does a frontal jab. He just goes jab, and then he turns it as well, and that's all he has to do.
Yeah.
Now, if anyone's ever dealt with martial arts when it comes to weaponry, there are certain places that you put a knife in, and that's all you have to do. That's it. One jab, the person will be dead in 30 seconds.
Cannot be repaired. And it seems like it really is the surprise element that he has gone for. It is a surprise attack, so that there is nothing he can do about it. He says, "I have a message from God for you."
Exactly.
Yeah. Says he rose from his seat. He could mm-hmm. reached out with his left hand, took the dagger from his right thigh, and thrust it into his belly. Now, shall I keep reading?
Now, remember, he was fat. It says bari me'od. So the word bari in Hebrew usually means healthy, and the Bible usually means fat.
I've got here in brackets, and this is in verse 17. Now, Eglon was a very fat man. This is what I've got.
In the Hebrew, it says bari me'od, which means very healthy. So they understood that being fat meant healthy.
In this case, when
they saw someone thin, they considered that person to be thin and unhealthy. And this is why, for example, when you look at imagery of, say, women up to, my guess is 40 years ago, men wanted women to be a bit more chunky because that was healthy. And today, this anorexic style is, first of all, unhealthy in certain cases. But it's a relatively new thing. It's a new trend. Men were considered to be healthier if they were heavy.
Mm-hmm.
If they were, for example, you can have a giant, for example. You have a guy who's really, really big, full of muscles and everything. And we automatically think, oh, that person's healthy. So it was mm-hmm. really a perception of the eyes and not a perception of understanding what's going on in the interior. For example, I just watched a program about the effect of steroids on people's bodies. And a guy could be, for example, full of muscles and everything. Looking really, really healthy in the inside, it's a catastrophe.
Mm, mm.
But they perceive what they saw with their own eyes. So they saw someone, someone's like nice and chunky, then they're healthy.
Sure.
It might be a diabetic as well, but that's besides the point.
So in the English, I've got a very fat man, but perhaps he was very healthy. But in any case, and here it is, this is a little bit gory, so I'm just warning you now. It says in verse 22, He thrust it into his belly. Even the hilt, the handle, went in after the blade, and the fat closed over the blade, for he did not draw out the dagger out of his belly, and his entrails came out. And then he would went through
your,
the bush.
Your one says entrails? Okay.
What do you got?
No, because what it says here, there's two things you have to point out. First, it says here, so it's referring to his fat as chelev.
Okay,
so it's interesting. It doesn't use the word shuman. It uses the word chelev, which is interesting. Mm-hmm. Chelev, if you remember the discussion we had about the forbidden fats.
Yes.
The chelev was like chelev is really a softer type of fat. That's one of the differences.
Sure.
When you use, okay, in the culinary world, when you use colon fat or tail fat, it's a type of fat that's softer and breaks apart more easily. When mm-hmm. you're dealing with fat, for example, there's pieces of meat, but there's a fat cap on top. Yes. You actually have to cut off that cap. Now, when you take that cap, it's very hard. It's very gritty.
Yep.
The only way to use it is to really grind it. When you take the concept of chelev,
it's very gristly, right? Yeah.
Exactly. If you take, for example, chelev, you take fat and you fry it, it just fries and turns, slightly more edible and it gets a flavor. When you take chelev, colon fat, tail fat, whatever it would be, and you use it, it melts. So it's actually describing the type of fat he had. He had soft fat. He was so heavy.
Hang on. So when
he was
says,
so heavy, he was basically a blubber ball, probably, or something.
So
like that.
When it says that his entrails came out,
and when he puts the knife in, it's so he's so fat that it basically enclosed. But that's besides the point. Then what it says here at the end, you're the one who said it's gory. I'm trying to explain what's going on here in the text.
All right.
And for example, it says here, he closed and everything. It says Vayetzeh Hapal Shedona. Mm-hmm. And it says Vayetzeh Ehuda Misdarona. So first of all, there's a sound game here, the at the end, which is sure. I usually use this as a classic example. And it's right. So for example, there's basically going out to the Misdaron. So in Hebrew, we have a thing called a directive hey, which basically means if one's moving from one point to the other point, then we describe he is going to XYZ. So we use a special suffix on the name of the place that he's moving to. Mm-hmm. And that might be why they're using why the word perish becomes parshedona, because the dalet there is pointless. So it's probably this is why I claim that it says here that the dalet is added to the word perish because it's just trying to imitate some kind of a sound with the word misdalon. But the word perish usually means what comes out after you eat. By the way,
Right.
So there's actually a thing when
it's even more disgusting than I thought.
You can edit this out if you want, but basically there's a case when one goes into complete shock. This is how effective it was what he did. Mm-hmm. He knew exactly what he was doing. So you were talking about knowing how to fight. He knew very well what he was doing.
Yeah.
Wow.
So he stabs him in a certain way.
Yeah.
And he runs out. He locks the door. So he's allowing him to die. So the stabbing itself was damaging enough to him to go into a catatonic state where he can't yell, scream, or anything.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And he's probably bleeding to death.
Sure.
Or there's internal hemorrhaging. And he's collapsing. He collapses and Ehud runs out. He locks the door and he runs out. He basically vanishes.
He makes a successful escape. And meanwhile,
Stealth behavior. He gets out. And then meanwhile, the door's locked. And the servants are sitting there going like, okay, we're waiting here. And you're right. It's kind of gory because what's the next thing he says? They're waiting there and they're saying maybe he's using the potty.
Right. That's what I was wondering because let me read you what I've got in English. I've got they were surprised that the doors were the upper room they were locked, and so they said, well, he's probably attending to his needs in the cool chamber. And so what you're saying is that he's relieving himself. You know,
he's relieving himself.
And so they waited until they were embarrassed, and they thought, man, this guy's really got some issues with going. And he still had not opened the doors of the upper room. Therefore, they took the key and opened it. And when they opened it up, they found their master fallen dead on the floor. And just, you know, he's still got the knife in him. He's still got the dagger in him.
So, by the way, mentions here the thing of a cool room or the cooling room.
Mm-hmm.
So it's called Cheder HaMekareh from the word kar. And what's very, very interesting is that the fact that they basically had some kind of a style of an air conditioning. And I remember I was watching a program about, for example, how the Egyptians cooled down their houses, and the royalty they basically had, the walls were hollow. They had summer houses, and the walls were hollow, and they would stream water through these channels in the wall itself,
really?
And it cooled down the walls, which caused the room to cool down.
Right.
Here, I read a description of what they presume was done here. They had a room,
mm-hmm.
and it was open to the northern side of the world, and usually the air that comes from the north here was usually cooler.
Sure.
So it traps the northern wind into the room itself, which causes the room to cool down.
Cool. That's great. Wow.
You have to remember that they were building structures here, and they actually knew what was going on. For example, you want sunlight, you build to the east. You open your windows to the east mm-hmm. and the west.
Mm-hmm.
You want air circulation, you open up windows from the north to the south.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And that's how you get air circulation. Because eastern wind is usually very, very, very hot. Western wind, if it's northwestern wind, it's wind that's coming also from the ocean. Mm. So it's slightly damper. And he was living in Moab, which means he was living in the desert. So he doesn't want damp, he wants cold.
He wants cool, yeah. And so that's interesting. So a specific type of architecture, which would he would actually have a cool room. Meanwhile, Ehud has escaped. He's gone back to Israel. He said, "Hey, come on! Now is our time to shine." And blows the trumpets on Mount Ephraim. The children of Israel went down with him from the mountains, and he led them Follow me, he said, because Yehovah has delivered your enemy, the Moabites, into your hands. So they went down after him and they seized the fords of the Jordan leading to Moab. They didn't allow anyone to cross over, and at that time they killed about 10,000 men of Moab, and all stout men of valor. Not a man escaped. So Moab was
subdued. What your one says, stout men of valor. My word says shamin.
What was that?
All fat men.
Really?
Yeah.
Hang on. No. Wait. Is that the same word that's used in regards to Eglon in 17? No.
So verse 17? In Eglon it says barim me'od, and then it uses the word chelev. Here it's shamin. Shamen basically means fat, so it's very, very interesting. You know, let me actually look at the dictionary just a second. The word shamen, there might be a different usage here, but I think just shamen.
But it seems to be making fat. The point that the Moabites' diet
were
was
fat.
Was the Moabites' diet? Oh, wasn't
I'll,
very
I'll,
good.
I'll tell you why. There's actually probably a very good reason for it. If, for example, you look in Isaiah, it mentions in several places that the king of Moab was a herdsman. So it could be that their diet consisted mostly of eating meat, and that's why they were fat.
Meat and wheat. Actually, you know what? It's interesting. We were talking
because
recently
they were living
about,
in the desert.
About the Egyptians and the archaeological evidence that points to the Egyptians having an epidemic of obesity and diabetes and things like that.
Yeah, well, I would find it very, very peculiar that the Egyptians had such issues. I mean, I just actually looked and watched a survey about what they discovered about Egyptians, and there was a stage in Egyptian history that there was this entire group in society that suffered from malnutrition to a point where they started dropping dead at a very, very early age. But they attribute that to the slave to the slaves in Egypt. But when it comes to the Egyptians themselves, many of them were actually borderline vegetarians, probably.
Mm. We were looking at the example of Hatshepsut.
Hatshepsut?
The queen was a king.
Oh, Hatshepsut, as far as I know, lived to a very old age.
Oh, you better have a look. Better have a look at her coffin. It was
no,
huge.
No, she became what?
It was a huge mummy.
Interesting. I have to look. Let me look into that again. No, maybe she was very, very fat. I mean,
there's some homework for the listeners. So,
yeah, again, if I remember correctly, Hatshepsut lived into like her 60s or something. Like that. But again, I'm not an Egyptologist. I don't really know enough about Egypt to start giving you the chronologies and ages of each kings. But there were pharaohs there. There were pharaohs, for example, Ramses II was pharaoh for a very, very, very long time, like 62 years or something.
Mm. Well, that's a good point. That's a good point. Well, regardless of the Egyptians, it seems like the men of Moab, and particularly their leader, seemed to be of a rather heavy carriage. Fat. And so Moab was subdued that day under the hand of Israel, and the land had rest for 80 years. Now, the next verse is so cool. Can you read it for us? Verse 31.
Okay, so it says, V'acharav haya shamgar ben anat v'yachet perishtim 600 ish v'imlamed habakar v'yosha gamhu et Yisrael. So after him, there was Shamgar, the son of Anat, which is a very, very peculiar name. Shamgar is not really a Hebrew name. Anat is the name of a Canaanite goddess. So I saw someone who claimed that he was probably might have not been an Israelite. He might have been a convert or something.
I was going to ask
but
you
he
that.
Because
it talks about, sorry to interrupt, but it talks about, I mean, we only just read in verse 5, was it? Verse 6, and they took their daughters to be their wives and their daughters to be their son, gave their daughters to be sons.
So there's also
and they
possibility.
Served other gods. Is it possible that an Israelite man married for example, I don't know, a Moabite or one of the Canaanite women, and here is their son, and it's not a Hebrew name, and yet he is faithful to Yehovah, as far as we know, and he has this one verse. There's also one other verse, I think, in the Bible that mentions him, but this verse highlights and memorializes this man for what he did. And it doesn't say that he was a judge, but it says at the end that he also delivered Israel. So he kind of falls into that category, right?
No, he was a judge. There's no reason not to say he was not a judge. The issue is, where did he come from? That's why we're looking at his name. His name is very, very, very unusual. But what he does is even more amazing, that he goes and he smites the 600 Philistines with a cattle drive.
What's a cattle drive?
Or whatever he can call it, it's basically he just took probably some kind of a stick or maybe a rod. I mean, actually, it's a very good question. Maybe it's some kind of a Let me look if I can find a picture of one of these things, and then I can actually know what it is.
What I've got in the English is an ox goad, but I have no idea what an ox goad is. But whatever it is, this guy, and we assume.
It says here it was himself. It says it was a long rod. In the end, there was some kind of sharp piece of metal. So it was almost like a spear or something, but it was used for animals.
Okay, so it was
a cattle prod or something. He was basically going all Shaolin on them. He was basically using a very, very, you know, the monks of Shaolin, basically their weapons are very, very simple. Huh? And he just basically took a staff, which had a sharp end at the end, and he basically used it to kill 600 men.
600 men? My goodness. That's pretty, 600 Philistines, seemingly by himself. And so he also delivered Israel. There is one verse dedicated to Shamgar, 600 Philistines, my goodness, with a cattle prod. Now listen, it took us that long to get to the end of chapter 3. Are we going to get into chapter 4 or should we leave that till next time? Because that's going to go into chapter 5. We kind of suggested to everyone that we were going to do Deborah.
So rather than just looking at Queen Hatshepsut's CT, and they say here she had some kind of, if she probably had some kind of, her gallbladder had some kind of infection, she might have had some kind of bone cancer, and maybe diabetes.
Okay. Is this Hatshepsut?
Hatshepsut, yeah.
Okay.
So she was the queen for 21 years, but you have to remember that she lived before she became queen, and she also was queen by default because the king himself, the child who was supposed to be king, was too young to be king. So she took over. So she was basically the crown protector for 21 years.
And she appreciated a good beard.
And well, she was trying to be a man.
She just so people know what we're talking about. She was an Egyptian queen, if you like, who really, for all intents and purposes, became a king and had a fake beard fixed to her chin as part of her royal, what shall we say?
Well, all the statues, it's very interesting. All the statues of the pharaohs, if you look at them, I actually just listened to a whole lecture about Egypt. All the statues of pharaohs were more or less the same. The body, the physique was always the same, and then he had the face itself of the pharaoh. Now, what she was doing is because she, you know, women usually couldn't be a pharaoh. I think she was like one of the only ones who could be a pharaoh. There wasn't one of the only ones that actually was a pharaoh. She made sure that the body part of her torso would look masculine. And then they actually had her face and they made sure she had a pharaoh beard. And she was basically trying to, you know, say, I'm a pharaoh as well. And a pharaoh usually has a beard. But they also, I think they found statues where you actually can see feminine features as well.
Yes, and, I did.
Yeah, and it's very, very interesting. Actually, it's kind of funny because Immanuel Velikovsky tried to claim that Queen Hatshepsut was the Queen of Sheba. He uses a completely different chronology, which moves Queen Hatshepsut to the 10th century BCE instead of being in the 15th century BCE. And then he says, okay, she was the same. She was the queen of Sheba, which we, you know, it's again, Sheva is actually a place in Saudi Arabia. Yeah.
That met up with Solomon.
Yeah. Now, what's very interesting also with Queen Hatshepsut is that she actually, in her tomb, I think it's in her tomb, there's actually a chronicle of her with her servants traveling to the land of Raznu or Rathnu, and basically that was another name for the land of Canaan.
Mm.
And it says that she met up. Actually, it's very interesting because one of the things that happened with Queen Hatshepsut is after she died, they chiseled out her name many times in her face. And in her tomb, at least according to what Velikovsky claimed, because I never actually found a picture of this, in the tomb they say that it was one of the only times where they saw an image of the pharaoh, in this case Hatshepsut, with an image of another person and they're at the same height. Usually the pharaoh in these images, usually the pharaoh is big and the rest of the commoners are small.
Mm.
And here this was the only case. And they actually say, what Velikovsky claims is based on the clothing, this person was a Semite. He wasn't Egyptian. The dress code wasn't Egyptian.
Hmm.
And there's actually a record there of everything that happened. And they met up, and it's obvious they're meeting up with a Semitic group. And they're all bearded. And then I showed a picture of this to my friend. He said to me, notice the fact that they all have fringes on their clothing as well. They all have strings hanging out from the clothing. Right. So maybe Velikovsky was right. Maybe he was not. It's very interesting. But Queen Hatshepsut is an anomaly, at least in the Egyptian history.
Yeah.
And actually, there was a time when they believed that she was a man. They thought it was a man until they discovered the tomb and then realized it was a woman.
Yeah, yeah. She was a king, but she was a woman.
Yeah.
There it is. upset soon. So, listen, I reckon I'm going to hold off. I'm going to hold off Chapter 4 and Chapter 5 until next week. Sorry, folks, but okay. It's going to happen. Because I think, you know, Devorah, the prophetess, she deserves some extra focus. And these are two very important chapters.
Then someone's going to claim that it's because you didn't have time because you chit-chatted in the beginning.
It's because we schmoozed at the beginning of it and because we had a big theological argument before we even started.
Yeah, so this is how it happens, and this is how Sundays the recordings are. And, you know.
It's all right.
Yeah, I think it's okay that we do this.
We'll get there eventually. My friend Yoel Ben Shlomo, his Facebook page is Hebrew in Israel. By the way, there is a link on the right-hand side of truth2u.org, truth2u.org, where you can click on that. It will take you to his Facebook page. You can like the page. You can engage with him there and get into all sorts of arguments like I do.
No. The point is not to argue. The point is to schmooze.
You can schmooze with Yoel on Hebrew in Israel.
The point is to have a discussion. And by the way, I want to also thank... There were two more people who sent money to help me travel to see my father. We're actually getting very, very close to the amount of money I need. So I want to thank those people as well. And, you know, help Jono go visit the Holy Land.
Hey, I'm heading over to your place. You're going over to the States to see your father, and who you haven't seen for 2.5 years. So we really do appreciate those of the listeners that have given back to Yoel for all the time that he has given to us so generously in going through these passages, these chapters in light of the prophets. And I would encourage listeners to continue to do that if you would like to make a contribution back to Yoel so that he can get over there. And God willing, maybe, Yoel, maybe you might be able to meet up with some people while you're over there. Who knows? Let's see what happens.
So what I'll do is when I get to fly to the United States, I'll basically tell you where I will be. And if someone wants to set up a meeting, you know...
let's see what we can do.
You can just send me a message and we'll see if we can do it.
Brilliant. Okay. Yep. And once again, HebrewInIsrael@gmail.com. If you want to get on the waiting list there for quality Hebrew lessons, you can certainly do that by emailing Yoel@HebrewInIsrael@gmail.com. And if these programs have been a blessing to you, you can also show your support by donating at truth2u.org. That's truth2u.org. And as Yoel mentioned, I am putting together, or very, I'd like to thank all the listeners that are contributing to my funds to get over to Israel, because we want to... But basically, what we're going to do is bother Yoel. But while we're there doing that, we want to also document the tour of Keith Johnson's tour that he's doing. We want to document that on Truth to You and put out some programs from the land, which will be a first. And I'm really looking forward to that. And thank you to the listeners that are helping me do that. So next week, dear listeners, we are going to be doing Devorah. That is Judges Chapter 4 and the Song of Devorah Chapter 5. We're going to be putting some extra special focus on her as she deserves. And until then, dear listeners, be blessed, be set apart by the truth of our Father's word. Shalom.
Shalom.